16 miles from Hollabrunn, received Murat's dispatch with the proposal of a truce and a capitulation, he detected a ruse and wrote the following letter to Murat. Schönbrunn, 25th Brumaire, 1805, at 8 o'clock in the morning, to Prince Murat. I cannot find words to express to you my displeasure. You command only my advance guard and have no right to arrange an armistice without my order. You are causing me to lose the fruits of a campaign. Break the armistice immediately and march on the enemy. Inform him that the general who signed that capitulation had no right to do so, and that no one but the Emperor of Russia has that right. If, however, the Emperor of Russia ratifies that convention, I will ratify it. But it is only a trick. March on. Destroy the Russian army. You are in a position to seize its baggage and artillery. The Russian Emperor's aide-de-camp is an imposter. Officers are nothing when they have no powers. This one had none. The Austrians let themselves be tricked at the crossing of the Vienna Bridge. You are letting yourself be tricked by an aide-de-camp of the Emperor. Napoleon. Bonaparte's adjutant rode full gallop with this menacing letter to Murat. Bonaparte himself, not trusting to his generals, moved with all the guards to the field of battle, afraid of letting a ready victim escape. And Bagration's 4,000 men merrily lighted camp fires, dried and warmed themselves, cooked their porridge for the first time for 3 days, and not one of them knew or imagined what was in store for him. Note, Napoleon's letter to Murat is taken from Thiers' Histoire du Consulat et de l'Empire. Chapter 11. Prince Andrew reports to Bagration. Captain Tushin, soldiers at the front, Dolokhov talks to a French grenadier. Between 3 and 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Prince Andrew, who had persisted in his request to Kutuzov, arrived at Grunt and reported himself to Bagration. Bonaparte's adjutant had not yet reached Murat's detachment, and the battle had not yet begun. In Bagration's detachment, no one knew anything of the general position of affairs. They talked of peace, but did not believe in its possibility. Others talked of a battle, but also disbelieved in the nearness of an engagement. Bagration, knowing Bolkonski to be a favorite and trusted adjutant, received him with distinction and special marks of favor, explaining to him that there would probably be an engagement that day or the next, and giving him full liberty to remain with him during the battle, or to join the rear guard and have an eye on the order of retreat, which is also very important. However, there will hardly be an engagement today, said Bagration, as if to reassure Prince Andrew. If he is one of the ordinary little staff dandies sent to earn a medal, he can get his reward just as well in the rear guard. But if he wishes to stay with me, let him. He'll be of use here if he's a brave officer, thought Bagration. Prince Andrew, without replying, asked the prince's permission to ride round the position to see the disposition of the forces, so as to know his bearings should he be sent to execute an order. The officer on duty, a handsome, elegantly dressed man with a diamond ring on his forefinger, who was fond of speaking French, though he spoke it badly, offered to conduct Prince Andrew. On all sides they saw rain-soaked officers with dejected faces who seemed to be seeking something, and soldiers dragging doors, benches, and fencing from the village. "There now, Prince, we can't stop those fellows," said the staff officer, pointing to the soldiers. "The officers don't keep them in hand. And there," he pointed to a sutler's tent, "they crowd in and sit. This morning I turned them all out, and now look, it's full again. I must go there, Prince, and scare them a bit. It won't take a moment." "Yes, let's go in, and I will get myself a roll and some cheese," said Prince Andrew, who had not yet had time to eat anything. "Why didn't you mention it, Prince? I would have offered you something." They dismounted and entered the tent. Several officers, with flushed and weary faces, were sitting at the table, eating and drinking. "Now, what does this mean, gentlemen?" said the staff officer, in the reproachful tone of a man who has repeated the same thing more than once. "You know it won't do to leave your posts like this. The prince gave orders that no one should leave his post. Now you, captain," and he turned to a thin, dirty little artillery officer, who, without his boots, He had given them to the canteen keeper to dry. In only his stockings, rose when they entered, smiling not altogether comfortably. "Well, aren't you ashamed of yourself, Captain Tushin?" he continued. "One would think that as an artillery officer you would set a good example, yet here you are without your boots. The alarm will be sounded, and you'll be in a pretty position without your boots." The staff officer smiled. "Kindly report to your post, gentlemen, all of you. All," he added in a tone of command. Prince Andrew smiled involuntarily as he looked at the artillery officer Tushin, who, silent and smiling, shifting from one stockinged foot to the other, glanced inquiringly with his large, intelligent, kindly eyes from Prince Andrew to the staff officer. "The soldiers say it feels easier without boots," said Captain Tushin, smiling shyly in his uncomfortable position, evidently wishing to adopt a jocular tone. But before he had finished, he felt that his jest was unacceptable and had not come off. He grew confused. "Kindly return to your posts," said the staff officer, trying to preserve his gravity. Prince Andrew glanced again at the artillery officer's small figure. There was something peculiar about it, quite unsoldierly, rather comic, but extremely attractive. The staff officer and Prince Andrew mounted their horses and rode on. Having ridden beyond the village, continually meeting and overtaking soldiers and officers of various regiments, they saw on their left some entrenchments being thrown up, the freshly dug clay of which showed up red. Several battalions of soldiers in their shirt sleeves, despite the cold wind, swarmed in these earthworks like a host of white ants. Spadefuls of red clay were continually being thrown up from behind the bank by unseen hands. Prince Andrew and the officer rode up, looked at the entrenchment, and went on again. Just behind it, they came upon some dozens of soldiers continually replaced by others who ran from the entrenchment. They had to hold their noses and put their horses to a trot to escape from the poisoned atmosphere of these latrines. "Voilà la Grémont des camps, Monsieur le Prince. This is a pleasure one gets in camp, Prince," said the staff officer. They rode up the opposite hill. From there the French could already be seen. Prince Andrew stopped and began examining the position. "That's our battery," said the staff officer, indicating the highest point. "It's in charge of the queer fellow we saw without his boots. You can see everything from there. Let's go there, Prince." "Thank you very much. I will go alone," said Prince Andrew, wishing to rid himself of this staff officer's company. "Please don't trouble yourself any further." The staff officer remained behind, and Prince Andrew rode on alone. The farther forward and nearer the enemy he went, the more orderly and cheerful were the troops. The greatest disorder and depression had been in the baggage train he had passed that morning on the Tsnaim Road, 7 miles away from the French. At Grunt also, some apprehension and alarm could be felt. But the nearer Prince Andrew came to the French lines, the more confident was the appearance of our troops. The soldiers in their greatcoats were ranged in lines. The sergeants major and company officers were counting the men, poking the last man in each section in the ribs and telling him to hold his hand up. Soldiers scattered over the whole place were dragging logs and brushwood and were building shelters with merry chatter and laughter. Around the fires sat others, dressed and undressed, drying their shirts and leg bands or mending boots or overcoats and crowding round the boilers and porridge cookers. In one company dinner was ready, and the soldiers were gazing eagerly at the steaming boiler, waiting till the sample which a quartermaster sergeant was carrying in a wooden bowl to an officer who sat on a log before his shelter had been tasted. Another company, a lucky one, for not all the companies had vodka, crowded round a pock-marked, broad-shouldered sergeant major who, tilting a keg, filled one after another the canteen lids held out to him. The soldiers lifted the canteen lids to their lips with reverential faces, emptied them, rolling the vodka in their mouths, and walked away from the sergeant major with brightened expressions, licking their lips and wiping them on the sleeves of their greatcoats. All their faces were as serene as if all this were happening at home, awaiting peaceful encampment, and not within sight of the enemy, before an action in which at least half of them would be left on the field. After passing a chasseur regiment and in the lines of the Kiev Grenadiers, fine fellows busy with similar peaceful affairs, near the shelter of the regimental commander, higher then and different from the others, Prince Andrew came out in front of a platoon of grenadiers, before whom lay a naked man. Two soldiers held him, while two others were flourishing their switches and striking him regularly on his bare back. The man shrieked unnaturally. A stout major was pacing up and down the line, and regardless of the screams, kept repeating, "It's a shame for a soldier to steal. A soldier must be honest, honorable, and brave. But if he robs his fellows, there is no honor in him. He's a scoundrel. Go on. Go on." So the swishing sound of the strokes and the desperate but unnatural screams continued. "Go on, go on," said the major. A young officer with a bewildered and pained expression on his face stepped away from the man and looked round inquiringly at the adjutant as he rode by. Prince Andrew, having reached the front line, rode along it. Our front line and that of the enemy were far apart on the right and left flanks, but in the center, where the men with a flag of truce had passed that morning, the lines were so near together that the men could see one another's faces and speak to one another. Besides the soldiers who formed the picket line on either side, there were many curious onlookers who, jesting and laughing, stared at their strange foreign enemies. Since early morning, despite an injunction not to approach the picket line, the officers had been unable to keep sightseers away. The soldiers forming the picket line, like showmen exhibiting a curiosity, no longer looked at the French, but paid attention to the sightseers and grew weary, waiting to be relieved. Prince Andrew halted to have a look at the French. "Look, look there," one soldier was saying to another, pointing to a Russian musketeer who had gone up to the picket line with an officer and was rapidly and excitedly talking to a French grenadier. "Hark to him jabbering. Fine, isn't it? It's all the French he can do to keep up with him. There now, Sidorov." "Wait a bit and listen. It's fine," answered Sidorov, who was considered an adept at French. The soldier to whom the laughers referred was Dolohov. Prince Andrew recognized him and stopped to listen to what he was saying. Dolohov had come from the left flank where their regiment was stationed with his captain. "Now then, go on, go on," incited the officer, bending forward and trying not to lose a word of the speech which was incomprehensible to him. "More, please, more. What's he saying?" Dolohov did not answer the captain. He had been drawn into a hot dispute with the French grenadier. They were naturally talking about the campaign. The Frenchman, confusing the Austrians with the Russians, was trying to prove that the Russians had surrendered and had fled all the way from Ulm, while Dolohov maintained that the Russians had not surrendered, but had beaten the French. "We have orders to drive you off here, and we shall drive you off," said Dolohov. "Only take care you and your Cossacks are not all captured," said the French grenadier. The French onlookers and listeners laughed. "We'll make you dance as we did under Suvorov." "On vous fera danser," said Dolohov. "Qu'est-ce qu'il chante?" "What's he singing about?" asked a Frenchman. "It's ancient history," said another, guessing that it referred to a former war. "The emperor will teach your Suvara as he has taught the others." "Bonaparte," began Dolohov, but the Frenchman interrupted him. "Not Bonaparte. He is the emperor. Sacré nom!" cried he angrily. "The devil skin your emperor." And Dolohov swore at him in coarse soldier's Russian, and shouldering his musket, walked away. "Let us go, Ivan Lukitch," he said to the captain. "Ah, that's the way to talk French," said the picket soldiers. "Now, Sidorov, you have a try." Sidorov, turning to the French, winked and began to jabber meaningless sounds very fast. "Kari maletafa safi mutter kaska," he said, trying to give an expressive intonation to his voice.
"Ho, ho, ho! Ha, ha, ha! Woo-hoo!"
came peals of such healthy and good-humored laughter from the soldiers that it infected the French involuntarily, so much so that the only thing left to do seemed to be to unload the muskets, explode the ammunition, and all return home as quickly as possible. But the guns remained loaded, the loopholes in blockhouses and entrenchments looked out just as menacingly, and the unlimbered cannon confronted one another as before. Chapter 12. Prince Andrew surveys the position. The first shot. Having ridden round the whole line from right flank to left, Prince Andrew made his way up to the battery from which the staff officer had told him the whole field could be seen. Here he dismounted and stopped beside the farthest of the four unlimbered cannon. Before the guns, an artillery sentry was pacing up and down. He stood at attention when the officer arrived, but at a sign resumed his measured, monotonous pacing. Behind the guns were their limbers, and still farther back, picket ropes and artillerymen's bonfires. To the left, not far from the farthest cannon, was a small, newly constructed wattle shed from which came the sound of officers' voices in eager conversation. It was true that a view over nearly the whole Russian position and the greater part of the enemy's opened out from this battery. Just facing it, on the crest of the opposite hill, the village of Schöngrabern could be seen. And in three places, to left and right, the French troops, amid the smoke of their campfires, the greater part of whom were evidently in the village itself and behind the hill. To the left from that village, amid the smoke, was something resembling a battery, but it was impossible to see it clearly with the naked eye. Our right flank was posted on a rather steep incline, which dominated the French position. Our infantry was stationed there, and at the farthest point the dragoons. In the center, where Tushin's battery stood and from which Prince Andrew was surveying the position, was the easiest and most direct descent and ascent to the brook separating us from Schöngrabern. On the left, our troops were close to a copse in which smoked the bonfires of our infantry who were felling wood. The French line was wider than ours, and it was plain that they could easily outflank us on both sides. Behind our position was a steep and deep dip, making it difficult for artillery and cavalry to retire. Prince Andrew took out his notebook and, leaning on the cannon, sketched a plan of the position. He made some notes on two points, intending to mention them to Bagration. His idea was first to concentrate all the artillery in the center, and secondly, to withdraw the cavalry to the other side of the dip. Prince Andrew, being always near the commander-in-chief, closely followed the mass movements and general orders, and constantly studying historical accounts of battles, involuntarily pictured to himself the course of events in the forthcoming action in broad outline. He imagined only important possibilities. If the enemy attacks the right flank, he said to himself, the Kiev Grenadiers and the Podolsk Chasseurs must hold their position till reserves from the center come up. In that case, the Dragoons could successfully make a flank counterattack. If they attack our center, we, having the center battery on this high ground, shall withdraw the left flank under its cover and retreat to the dip by echelons. So he reasoned. All the time he had been beside the gun, he had heard the voices of the officers distinctly, but, as often happens, had not understood a word of what they were saying. Suddenly, however, he was struck by a voice coming from the shed, and its tone was so sincere that he could not but listen. "No, friend," said a pleasant voice, and, as it seemed to Prince Andrew, a familiar voice. "What I say is that if it were possible to know what is beyond death, none of us would be afraid of it. That's so, friend." Another, a younger voice, interrupted him. "Afraid or not, you can't escape it anyhow." "All the same, one is afraid." "Oh, you clever people," said a third manly voice, interrupting them both. "Of course you artillerymen are very wise, because you can take everything along with you, vodka and snacks." And the owner of the manly voice, evidently an infantry officer, laughed. "Yes, one is afraid," continued the first speaker, he of the familiar voice. "One is afraid of the unknown, that's what it is. Whatever we may say about the soul going to the sky, we know there is no sky, but only an atmosphere." The manly voice again interrupted the artillery officer. "Well, stand us some of your herb vodka, Tushin," it said. "Why," thought Prince Andrew, "that's the captain who stood up in the sutler's hut without his boots." He recognized the agreeable philosophizing voice with pleasure. "Some herb vodka? Certainly," said Tushin. But still, to conceive a future life... He did not finish. Just then there was a whistle in the air. Nearer and nearer, faster and louder, louder and faster, a cannonball, as if it had not finished saying what was necessary, thudded into the ground near the shed with superhuman force, throwing up a mass of earth. The ground seemed to groan at the terrible impact. And immediately Tushin, with a short pipe in the corner of his mouth, and his kind, intelligent face rather pale, rushed out of the shed, followed by the owner of the manly voice, a dashing infantry officer, who hurried off to his company, buttoning up his coat as he ran. Chapter 13. Bagration in action. Tushin's battery. Setting Schöngraben on fire. Mounting his horse again, Prince Andrew lingered with the battery, looking at the puff from the gun that had sent the ball. His eyes ran rapidly over the wide space, but he only saw that the hitherto motionless masses of the French now swayed, and that there really was a battery to their left. The smoke above it had not yet dispersed. Two mounted Frenchmen, probably adjutants, were galloping up the hill. A small but distinctly visible enemy column was moving down the hill, probably to strengthen the front line. The smoke of the first shot had not yet dispersed before another puff appeared, followed by a report. The battle had begun. Prince Andrew turned his head and galloped back to Grunt to find Prince Bagration. He heard the cannonade behind him growing louder and more frequent. Evidently, our guns had begun to reply. From the bottom of the slope, where the parleys had taken place, came the report of musketry. Le Marois had just arrived at a gallop with Bonaparte's stern letter, and Murat, humiliated and anxious to expiate his fault, had at once moved his forces to attack the center and outflank both the Russian wings, hoping before evening and before the arrival of the emperor to crush the contemptible detachment that stood before him. It has begun. Here it is, thought Prince Andrew, feeling the blood rush to his heart. But where and how will my Toulon present itself? Passing between the companies that had been eating porridge and drinking vodka a quarter of an hour before, he saw everywhere the same rapid movement of soldiers forming ranks and getting their muskets ready, and on all their faces he recognized the same eagerness that filled his heart. It has begun. Here it is, dreadful but enjoyable, was what the face of each soldier and each officer seemed to say. Before he had reached the embankments that were being thrown up, he saw in the light of the dull autumn evening mounted men coming toward him. The foremost, wearing a Cossack cloak and lambskin cap and riding a white horse, was Prince Bagration. Prince Andrew stopped, waiting for him to come up. Prince Bagration reined in his horse and, recognizing Prince Andrew, nodded to him. He still looked ahead while Prince Andrew told him what he had seen. The feeling, it has begun, here it is, was seen even on Prince Bagration's hard brown face with its half-closed, dull, sleepy eyes. Prince Andrew gazed with anxious curiosity at that impassive face and wished he could tell what, if anything, this man was thinking and feeling at that moment. Is there anything at all behind that impassive face? Prince Andrew asked himself as he looked. Prince Bagration bent his head in sign of agreement with what Prince Andrew told him, and said, "Very good," in a tone that seemed to imply that everything that took place and was reported to him was exactly what he had foreseen. Prince Andrew, out of breath with his rapid ride, spoke quickly. Prince Bagration, uttering his words with an Oriental accent, spoke particularly slowly, as if to impress the fact that there was no need to hurry. However, he put his horse to a trot in the direction of Tushin's battery. Prince Andrew followed with the suite. Behind Prince Bagration rode an officer of the suite, the prince's personal adjutant, Zhirkov, an orderly officer, the staff officer on duty riding a fine bob-tailed horse, and a civilian, an accountant who had asked permission to be present at the battle out of curiosity. The accountant, a stout, full-faced man, looked around him with a naive smile of satisfaction and presented a strange appearance among the hussars, Cossacks, and adjutants in his camlet coat, as he jolted on his horse with a convoy officer's saddle. "He wants to see a battle," said Zhirkov to Bolkonsky, pointing to the accountant. "But he feels a pain in the pit of his stomach already." "Oh, leave off," said the accountant with a beaming but rather cunning smile, as if flattered at being made the subject of Zhirkov's joke and purposely trying to appear stupider than he really was. "It is very strange, mon monsieur prince," said the staff officer. He remembered that in French there is some peculiar way of addressing a prince, but could not get it quite right. By this time they were all approaching Tushin's battery, and a ball struck the ground in front of them. "What's that that has fallen?" asked the accountant with a naive smile. "A French pancake," answered Zhirkov. "So that's what they hit with," asked the accountant. "How awful." He seemed to swell with satisfaction. He had hardly finished speaking when they again heard an unexpectedly violent whistling, which suddenly ended with a thud into something soft. Flop! And a Cossack, riding a little to their right and behind the accountant, crashed to earth with his horse. Zhirkov and the staff officer bent over their saddles and turned their horses away. The accountant stopped, facing the Cossack, and examined him with attentive curiosity. The Cossack was dead, but the horse still struggled. Prince Bagration screwed up his eyes, looked round, and, seeing the cause of the confusion, turned away with indifference, as if to say, "Is it worthwhile noticing trifles?" He reined in his horse with the ease of a skillful rider, and, slightly bending over, disengaged his saber, which had caught in his cloak. It was an old-fashioned saber of a kind no longer in general use. Prince Andrew remembered the story of Suvorov giving his saber to Bagration in Italy, and the recollection was particularly pleasant at that moment. They had reached the battery at which Prince Andrew had been when he examined the battlefield. "Whose company?" asked Prince Bagration of an artilleryman standing by the ammunition wagon. He asked, "Whose company?" but he really meant, "Are you frightened here?" And the artilleryman understood him. "Captain Tushin's, Your Excellency," shouted the red-haired, freckled gunner in a merry voice, standing to attention. "Yes, yes," muttered Bagration, as if considering something, and he rode past the limbers to the farthest cannon. As he approached, a ringing shot issued from it, deafening him and his suite, and in the smoke that suddenly surrounded the gun, they could see the gunners who had seized it straining to roll it quickly back to its former position. A huge, broad-shouldered gunner, number one, holding a mop, his legs far apart, sprang to the wheel, while number two, with a trembling hand, placed a charge in the cannon's mouth. The short, round-shouldered Captain Tushin, stumbling over the tail of the gun carriage, moved forward and, not noticing the general, looked out, shading his eyes with his small hand. "Lift it two lines more and it will be just right," cried he in a feeble voice, to which he tried to impart a dashing note, ill-suited to his weak figure. "Number two," he squeaked. "Fire, Medvedev!" Bagration called to him, and Tushin, raising three fingers to his cap with a bashful and awkward gesture, not at all like a military salute, but like a priest's benediction, approached the general. Though Tushin's guns had been intended to cannonade the valley, he was firing incendiary balls at the village of Schöngraben, visible just opposite, in front of which large masses of French were advancing. No one had given Tushin orders where and at what to fire, but after consulting his sergeant-major, Zakharchenko, for whom he had great respect, he had decided that it would be a good thing to set fire to the village. "Very good," said Bagration in reply to the officer's report, and began deliberately to examine the whole battlefield extended before him. The French had advanced nearest on our right. Below the height on which the Kiev regiment was stationed, in the hollow where the rivulet flowed, the soul-stirring rolling and crackling of musketry was heard, and much farther to the right, beyond the dragoons, the officer of the suite pointed out to Bagration a French column that was outflanking us. To the left, the horizon was bounded by the adjacent wood. Prince Bagration ordered two battalions from the center to be sent to reinforce the right flank. The officer of the suite ventured to remark to the prince that if these battalions went away, the guns would remain without support. Prince Bagration turned to the officer and with his dull eyes looked at him in silence. It seemed to Prince Andrew that the officer's remark was just and that really no answer could be made to it. But at that moment, an adjutant galloped up with a message from the commander of the regiment in the hollow and news that immense masses of the French were coming down upon them and that his regiment was in disorder and was retreating upon the Kiev Grenadiers. Prince Bagration bowed his head in sign of assent and approval. He rode off at a walk to the right and sent an adjutant to the dragoons with orders to attack the French. But this adjutant returned half an hour later with the news that the commander of the dragoons had already retreated beyond the dip in the ground, as a heavy fire had been opened on him and he was losing men uselessly, and so had hastened to throw some sharpshooters into the wood. "Very good," said Bagration. As he was leaving the battery, firing was heard on the left also, and as it was too far to the left flank for him to have time to go there himself, Prince Bagration sent Zherkov to tell the general in command, the one who had paraded his regiment before Kutuzov at Braunau, that he must retreat as quickly as possible behind the hollow in the rear, as the right flank would probably not be able to withstand the enemy's attack very long. About Tushin and the battalion that had been in support of his battery, all was forgotten. Prince Andrew listened attentively to Bagration's colloquies with the commanding officers and the orders he gave them, and, to his surprise, found that no orders were really given, but that Prince Bagration tried to make it appear that everything done by necessity, by accident, or by the will of subordinate commanders, was done, if not by his direct command, at least in accord with his intentions. Prince Andrew noticed, however, that though what happened was due to chance and was independent of the commander's will, owing to the tact Bagration showed, his presence was very valuable. Officers who approached him with disturbed countenances became calm. Soldiers and officers greeted him gaily, grew more cheerful in his presence, and were evidently anxious to display their courage before him. Chapter 14. Battle Scenes. Quarrelsome Commanders. Nicholas injured. Prince Bagration, having reached the highest point of our right flank, began riding downhill to where the roll of musketry was heard, but where, on account of the smoke, nothing could be seen. The nearer they got to the hollow, the less they could see, but the more they felt the nearness of the actual battlefield. They began to meet wounded men. One with a bleeding head and no cap was being dragged along by two soldiers who supported him under the arms. There was a gurgle in his throat, and he was spitting blood. A bullet had evidently hit him in the throat or mouth. Another was walking sturdily by himself, but without his musket, groaning aloud and swinging his arm, which had just been hurt, while blood from it was streaming over his greatcoat as from a bottle. He had that moment been wounded, and his face showed fear rather than suffering. Crossing a road, they descended a steep incline and saw several men lying on the ground. They also met a crowd of soldiers, some of whom were unwounded. The soldiers were ascending the hill, breathing heavily, and despite the general's presence, were talking loudly and gesticulating. In front of them, rows of gray cloaks were already visible through the smoke, and an officer, catching sight of Bagration, rushed shouting after the crowd of retreating soldiers, ordering them back. Bagration rode up to the ranks along which shots crackled, now here and now there, drowning the sound of voices and the shouts of command. The whole air reeked with smoke. The excited faces of the soldiers were blackened with it. Some were using their ramrods, others putting powder on the touch pans or taking charges from their pouches, while others were firing, though who they were firing at could not be seen for the smoke, which there was no wind to carry away. A pleasant humming and whistling of bullets were often heard. "What is this?" thought Prince Andrew, approaching the crowd of soldiers. "It can't be an attack, for they are not moving. It can't be a square, for they are not drawn up for that." The commander of the regiment, a thin, feeble-looking old man with a pleasant smile, his eyelids drooping more than half over his old eyes, giving him a mild expression, rode up to Bagration and welcomed him as a host welcomes an honored guest. He reported that his regiment had been attacked by French cavalry, and that, though the attack had been repulsed, he had lost more than half his men. He said the attack had been repulsed, employing this military term to describe what had occurred to his regiment. But in reality, he did not himself know what had happened during that half hour to the troops entrusted to him, and could not say with certainty whether the attack had been repulsed or his regiment had been broken up. All he knew was that at the commencement of the action, balls and shells began flying all over his regiment and hitting men, and that afterwards someone had shouted, "Cavalry!" and our men had begun firing. They were still firing, not at the cavalry, which had disappeared, but at French infantry, who had come into the hollow and were firing at our men. Prince Bagration bowed his head as a sign that this was exactly what he had desired and expected. Turning to his adjutant, he ordered him to bring down the two battalions of the 6th Chasseurs, whom they had just passed. Prince Andrew was struck by the changed expression on Prince Bagration's face at this moment. It expressed the concentrated and happy resolution you see on the face of a man who on a hot day takes a final run before plunging into the water. The dull, sleepy expression was no longer there, nor the affectation of profound thought. The round, steady hawk's eyes looked before him eagerly and rather disdainfully, not resting on anything, although his movements were still slow and measured. The commander of the regiment turned to Prince Bagration, entreating him to go back, as it was too dangerous to remain where they were. "Please, Your Excellency, for God's sake," he kept saying, glancing for support at an officer of the suite who turned away from him. "There, you see?" And he drew attention to the bullets whistling, singing, and hissing continually around them. He spoke in the tone of entreaty and reproach that a carpenter uses to a gentleman who has picked up an axe. "We're used to it, but you, sir, will blister your hands." He spoke as if those bullets could not kill him, and his half-closed eyes gave still more persuasiveness to his words. The staff officer joined in the colonel's appeals, but Bagration did not reply. He only gave an order to cease firing and reform, so as to give room for the two approaching battalions. While he was speaking, the curtain of smoke that had concealed the hollow, driven by a rising wind, began to move from right to left as if drawn by an invisible hand, and the hill opposite, with the French moving about on it, opened out before them. All eyes fastened involuntarily on this French column advancing against them and winding down over the uneven ground. One could already see the soldiers' shaggy caps, distinguish the officers from the men, and see the standard flapping against its staff. "They march splendidly," remarked someone in Bagration's suite. The head of the column had already descended into the hollow. The clash would take place on this side of it. The remains of our regiment, which had been in action, rapidly formed up and moved to the right. From behind it, dispersing the laggards, came two battalions of the 6th Chasseurs in fine order. Before they had reached Bagration, the weighty tread of the mass of men marching in step could be heard. On their left flank, nearest to Bagration, marched a company commander, a fine round-faced man with a stupid and happy expression, the same man who had rushed out of the wattle shed. At that moment he was clearly thinking of nothing but how dashing a fellow he would appear as he passed the commander. With the self-satisfaction of a man on parade, he stepped lightly with his muscular legs as if sailing along, stretching himself to his full height without the smallest effort, his ease contrasting with the heavy tread of the soldiers who were keeping step with him. He carried close to his leg a narrow, unsheathed sword, small, curved, and not like a real weapon, and looked now at the superior officers and now back at the men without losing step, his whole powerful body turning flexibly. It was as if all the powers of his soul were concentrated on passing the commander in the best possible manner, and feeling that he was doing it well, he was happy. "Left! Left! Left!" he seemed to repeat to himself at each alternate step, and in time to this, with stern but varied faces, the wall of soldiers, burdened with knapsacks and muskets, marched in step, and each one of these hundreds of soldiers seemed to be repeating to himself at each alternate step, "Left! Left! Left!" A fat major skirted a bush, puffing and falling out of step. A soldier who had fallen behind, his face showing alarm at his defection, ran at a trot, panting to catch up with his company. A cannonball cleaving the air flew over the heads of Bagration and his suite and fell into the column to the measure of left, left.
"Close up!"
came the company commander's voice in jaunty tones. The soldiers passed in a semicircle round something where the ball had fallen, and an old trooper on the flank, a non-commissioned officer who had stopped beside the dead men, ran to catch up his line, and, falling into step with a hop, looked back angrily. And through the ominous silence and the regular tramp of feet beating the ground in unison, one seemed to hear left, left, left.
"Well done, lads," said Prince Bagration.
"Glad to do our best, Your Excellency,"
came a confused shout from the ranks. A morose soldier marching on the left turned his eyes on Bagration as he shouted with an expression that seemed to say, "We know that ourselves." Another, without looking round, as though fearing to relax, shouted with his mouth wide open and passed on. The order was given to halt and down knapsacks. Bagration rode round the ranks that had marched past him and dismounted. He gave the reins to a Cossack, took off and handed over his felt coat, stretched his legs and set his cap straight. The head of the French column, with its officers leading, appeared from below the hill.
"Forward with God,"
said Bagration in a resolute, sonorous voice, turning for a moment to the front line, and slightly swinging his arms, he went forward uneasily over the rough field with the awkward gait of a cavalryman. Prince Andrew felt that an invisible power was leading him forward and experienced great happiness. The French were already near. Prince Andrew, walking beside Bagration, could clearly distinguish their bandoliers, red epaulettes, and even their faces. He distinctly saw an old French officer who, with gaitered legs and turned-out toes, climbed the hill with difficulty. Prince Bagration gave no further orders and silently continued to walk on in front of the ranks. Suddenly, one shot after another rang out from the French. Smoke appeared all along their uneven ranks, and musket shots sounded. Several of our men fell, among them the round-faced officer who had marched so gaily and complacently. But at the moment the first report was heard, Bagration looked round and shouted,
"Hurrah! Hurrah!"
rang a long-drawn shout from our ranks. And passing Bagration and racing one another, they rushed in an irregular but joyous and eager crowd down the hill at their disordered foe. Note: this was the attack of which Thiers says, "The Russians behaved courageously, and, what seldom happens in war, two bodies of infantry were seen marching resolutely against one another without either of them giving way before meeting." And Napoleon at St. Helena said, "Some Russian battalions showed entire fearlessness." The attack of the 6th Chasseurs secured the retreat of our right flank. In the center, Tushin's forgotten battery, which had managed to set fire to the Schöngrabern village, delayed the French advance. The French were putting out the fire, which the wind was spreading, and thus gave us time to retreat. The retirement of the center, to the other side of the dip in the ground at the rear, was hurried and noisy, but the different companies did not get mixed. But our left, which consisted of the Azov and Podolsk infantry and the Pavlograd Hussars, was simultaneously attacked and outflanked by superior French forces under Lannes, and was thrown into confusion. Bagration had sent Zhirkov to the general commanding that left flank with orders to retreat immediately. Zhirkov, not removing his hand from his cap, turned his horse about and galloped off, but no sooner had he left Bagration than his courage failed him. He was seized by panic and could not go where it was dangerous. Having reached the left flank, instead of going to the front where the firing was, he began to look for the general and his staff where they could not possibly be, and so did not deliver the order. The command of the left flank belonged by seniority to the commander of the regiment Kutuzov had reviewed at Braunau, and in which Dolokhov was serving as a private. But the command of the extreme left flank had been assigned to the commander of the Pavlograd regiment in which Rostov was serving, and a misunderstanding arose. The two commanders were much exasperated with one another, and long after the action had begun on the right flank, and the French were already advancing, were engaged in discussion with the sole object of offending one another. But the regiments, both cavalry and infantry, were by no means ready for the impending action. From privates to general, they were not expecting a battle, and were engaged in peaceful occupations, the cavalry feeding the horses, and the infantry collecting wood.
"He higher ist denn I in Rank," said the German colonel of the hussars, flushing and addressing an adjutant who had ridden up. "So let him do what he will, but I cannot sacrifice my hussars. Buckler, sound the retreat."
But haste was becoming imperative. Cannon and musketry, mingling together, thundered on the right and in the center, while the capotes of Lannes' sharpshooters were already seen crossing the mill dam and forming up within twice the range of a musket shot. The general in command of the infantry went toward his horse with jerky steps, and having mounted, drew himself up very straight and tall, and rode to the Pavlograd commander. The commanders met with polite bows, but with secret malevolence in their hearts.
"Once again, Colonel," said the general, "I can't leave half my men in the wood. I beg of you," he repeated, "to occupy the position and prepare for an attack." "I beg of you yourself not to mix in with what is not your business," suddenly replied the irate colonel. "If you were in the cavalry..." "I am not in the cavalry, Colonel, but I am a Russian general, and if you're not aware of the fact..." "Quite aware, Your Excellency," suddenly shouted the colonel, touching his horse and turning purple in the face. "Will you be so good to come to the front and see that this position is no good? I don't wish to destroy my men for your pleasure."
"You forget yourself, Colonel. I am not considering my own pleasure, and I won't allow it to be said."
Taking the colonel's outburst as a challenge to his courage, the general expanded his chest and rode frowning beside him to the front line, as if their differences would be settled there amongst the bullets. They reached the front. Several bullets sped over them, and they halted in silence. There was nothing fresh to be seen from the line, for from where they had been before it had been evident that it was impossible for cavalry to act among the bushes and broken ground, as well as that the French were outflanking our left. The general and colonel looked sternly and significantly at one another, like two fighting cocks preparing for battle, each vainly trying to detect signs of cowardice in the other. Both passed the examination successfully. As there was nothing to be said, and neither wished to give occasion for it to be alleged that he had been the first to leave the range of fire, they would have remained there for a long time testing each other's courage, had it not been that just then they heard the rattle of musketry and a muffled shout almost behind them in the wood. The French had attacked the men collecting wood in the copse. It was no longer possible for the hussars to retreat with the infantry. They were cut off from the line of retreat on the left by the French. However inconvenient the position, it was now necessary to attack in order to cut a way through for themselves. The squadron in which Rostov was serving had scarcely time to mount before it was halted facing the enemy. Again, as at the Enns Bridge, there was nothing between the squadron and the enemy, and again that terrible dividing line of uncertainty and fear, resembling the line separating the living from the dead, lay between them. All were conscious of this unseen line, and the question whether they would cross it or not, and how they would cross it, agitated them all. The colonel rode to the front, angrily gave some reply to questions put to him by the officers, and, like a man desperately insisting on having his own way, gave an order. No one said anything definite, but the rumor of an attack spread through the squadron. The command to form up rang out, and the sabers whizzed as they were drawn from their scabbards. Still no one moved. The troops of the left flank, infantry and hussars alike, felt that the commander did not himself know what to do, and this irresolution communicated itself to the men. If only they would be quick, thought Rostov, feeling that at last the time had come to experience the joy of an attack, of which he had so often heard from his fellow hussars.
"Forward with God, lads!" rang out Denisov's voice. "At a trot, forward!"
The horses' croups began to sway in the front line. Rook pulled at the reins and started of his own accord. Before him, on the right, Rostov saw the front lines of his hussars, and still farther ahead a dark line which he could not see distinctly but took to be the enemy. Shots could be heard, but some way off.
"Faster!"
came the word of command, and Rostov felt Rook's flanks drooping as he broke into a gallop. Rostov anticipated his horse's movements and became more and more elated. He had noticed a solitary tree ahead of him. This tree had been in the middle of the line that had seemed so terrible, and now he had crossed that line, and not only was there nothing terrible, but everything was becoming more and more happy and animated. "Oh, how I will slash at him," thought Rostov, gripping the hilt of his saber.
"Hurrah!"
came a roar of voices. "Let anyone come my way now," thought Rostov, driving his spurs into Rook and letting him go at a full gallop so that he outstripped the others. Ahead, the enemy was already visible. Suddenly, something like a birch broom seemed to sweep over the squadron. Rostov raised his saber, ready to strike, but at that instant the trooper Nikitenko, who was galloping ahead, shot away from him, and Rostov felt as in a dream that he continued to be carried forward with unnatural speed, but yet stayed on the same spot. From behind him, Bondarchuk, an hussar he knew, jolted against him and looked angrily at him. Bondarchuk's horse swerved and galloped past. "How is it I'm not moving? I've fallen. I'm killed," Rostov asked and answered at the same instant. He was alone in the middle of a field. Instead of the moving horses and hussars' backs, he saw nothing before him but the motionless earth and the stubble around him. There was warm blood under his arm. "No, I'm wounded, and the horse is killed." Rook tried to rise on his forelegs, but fell back, pinning his rider's leg. Blood was flowing from his head. He struggled, but could not rise. Rostov also tried to rise, but fell back, his saber-tash having become entangled in the saddle. Where our men were, and where the French, he did not know. There was no one near. Having disentangled his leg, he rose. Where, on which side, was now the line that had so sharply divided the two armies, he asked himself, and could not answer. Can something bad have happened to me? He wondered as he got up. And at that moment he felt that something superfluous was hanging on his benumbed left arm. The wrist felt as if it were not his. He examined his hand carefully, vainly trying to find blood on it. "Ah, here are people coming," he thought joyfully, seeing some men running toward him. "They will help me." In front came a man wearing a strange shako and a blue cloak, swarthy, sunburned, and with a hooked nose. Then came two more, and many more running behind. One of them said something strange, not in Russian. In among the hindmost of these men wearing similar shakos was a Russian hussar. He was being held by the arms, and his horse was being led behind him. "It must be one of ours, a prisoner." "Yes. Can it be that they will take me, too?" "Who are these men?" thought Rostov, scarcely believing his eyes. "Can they be French?" He looked at the approaching Frenchmen, and though but a moment before he had been galloping to get at them and hack them to pieces, their proximity now seemed so awful that he could not believe his eyes. "Who are they? Why are they running? Can they be coming at me? And why? To kill me? Me, whom everyone is so fond of?" He remembered his mother's love for him, and his family's, and his friends, and the enemy's intention to kill him seemed impossible. But perhaps they may do it. For more than 10 seconds he stood not moving from the spot or realizing the situation. The foremost Frenchman, the one with the hooked nose, was already so close that the expression of his face could be seen, and the excited alien face of that man, his bayonet hanging down, holding his breath and running so lightly, frightened Rostov. He seized his pistol, and instead of firing it, flung it at the Frenchman and ran with all his might toward the bushes. He did not now run with the feeling of doubt and conflict with which he had trodden the Enns bridge, but with the feeling of a hare fleeing from the hounds. One single sentiment, that of fear for his young and happy life, possessed his whole being. Rapidly leaping the furrows, he fled across the field with the impetuosity he used to show at catch play, now and then turning his good-natured, pale young face to look back. A shudder of terror went through him. "No, better not look," he thought. But having reached the bushes, he glanced round once more. The French had fallen behind, and just as he looked round, the first man changed his run to a walk, and turning, shouted something loudly to a comrade farther back. Rostov paused. "No, there's some mistake," thought he. They can't have wanted to kill me. But at the same time, his left arm felt as heavy as if a 70-pound weight were tied to it. He could run no more. The Frenchman also stopped and took aim. Rostov closed his eyes and stooped down. One bullet and then another whistled past him. He mustered his last remaining strength, took hold of his left hand with his right, and reached the bushes. Behind these were some Russian sharpshooters. Chapter 15. Panic. Timochin's counterattack. Dolokhov's insistence. Tushin's battery. Prince Andrew sent to order him to retreat. The infantry regiments that had been caught unawares in the outskirts of the wood ran out of it, the different companies getting mixed, and retreated as a disorderly crowd. One soldier, in his fear, uttered the senseless cry, "Cut off!" that is so terrible in battle, and that word infected the whole crowd with a feeling of panic.
"Surrounded! Cut off! We're lost!"
shouted the fugitives. The moment he heard the firing and the cry from behind, the general realized that something dreadful had happened to his regiment, and the thought that he, an exemplary officer of many years' service who had never been to blame, might be held responsible at headquarters for negligence or inefficiency, so staggered him that, forgetting the recalcitrant cavalry colonel, his own dignity as a general, and above all quite forgetting the danger and all regard for self-preservation, he clutched the crupper of his saddle and, spurring his horse, galloped to the regiment under a hail of bullets which fell around but fortunately missed him. His one desire was to know what was happening, and at any cost correct or remedy the mistake if he had made one, so that he, an exemplary officer of 22 years' service who had never been censured, should not be held to blame. Having galloped safely through the French, he reached a field behind the copse, across which our men, regardless of orders, were running and descending the valley. That moment of moral hesitation which decides the fate of battles had arrived. Would this disorderly crowd of soldiers attend to the voice of their commander, or would they, disregarding him, continue their flight? Despite his desperate shouts that used to seem so terrible to the soldiers, despite his furious purple countenance distorted out of all likeness to his former self, and the flourishing of his saber, the soldiers all continued to run, talking, firing into the air, and disobeying orders. The moral hesitation which decided the fate of battles was evidently culminating in a panic. The general had a fit of coughing as a result of shouting and of the powder smoke, and stopped in despair. Everything seemed lost. But at that moment, the French who were attacking suddenly and without any apparent reason ran back and disappeared from the outskirts, and Russian sharpshooters showed themselves in the copse. It was Timochin's company, which alone had maintained its order in the wood, and having lain in ambush in a ditch, now attacked the French unexpectedly. Timochin, armed only with a sword, had rushed at the enemy with such a desperate cry and such mad, drunken determination that, taken by surprise, the French had thrown down their muskets and run. Dolokhov, running beside Timochin, killed a Frenchman at close quarters and was the first to seize the surrendering French officer by his collar. Our fugitives returned, the battalions reformed, and the French who had nearly cut our left flank in half were for the moment repulsed. Our reserve units were able to join up, and the fight was at an end. The regimental commander and Major Yekonomov had stopped beside a bridge, letting the retreating companies pass by them, when a soldier came up and took hold of the commander's stirrup, almost leaning against him. The man was wearing a bluish coat of broadcloth. He had no knapsack or cap. His head was bandaged, and over his shoulder a French munition pouch was slung. He had an officer's sword in his hand. The soldier was pale, his blue eyes looked impudently into the commander's face, and his lips were smiling. Though the commander was occupied in giving instructions to Major Yekonomov, he could not help taking notice of the soldier.
"Your Excellency, here are two trophies," said Dolokhov, pointing to the French sword and pouch. "I've taken an officer prisoner. I stopped the company."
Dolokhov breathed heavily from weariness and spoke in abrupt sentences.
"The whole company can bear witness. I beg you will remember this, Your Excellency."
All right," replied the commander, and turned to Major Yekonomov. But Dolokhov did not go away. He untied the handkerchief around his head, pulled it off, and showed the blood congealed on his hair.
a bayonet wound. I remained at the front. Remember, Your Excellency.
Tushin's battery had been forgotten, and only at the very end of the action did Prince Bagration, still hearing the cannonade in the center, send his orderly staff officer, and later Prince Andrew also, to order the battery to retire as quickly as possible. When the supports attached to Tushin's battery had been moved away in the middle of the action by someone's order, the battery had continued firing, and was only not captured by the French because the enemy could not surmise that anyone could have the effrontery to continue firing from four quite undefended guns. On the contrary, the energetic action of that battery led the French to suppose that here, in the center, the main Russian forces were concentrated. Twice they had attempted to attack this point, but on each occasion had been driven back by grape shot from the four isolated guns on the hillock. Soon after Prince Bagration had left him, Tushin had succeeded in setting fire to Schöngraben.
"Look at them scurrying! It's burning! Just see the smoke! Fine! Grand! Look at the smoke! The smoke!" exclaimed the artilleryman, brightening up.
All the guns, without waiting for orders, were being fired in the direction of the conflagration. As if urging each other on, the soldiers cried at each shot, "Fine! That's good! Look at it! Grand!" The fire, fanned by the breeze, was rapidly spreading. The French columns that had advanced beyond the village went back. But as though in revenge for this failure, the enemy placed 10 guns to the right of the village and began firing them at Tushin's battery. In their childlike glee, aroused by the fire and their luck in successfully cannonading the French, our artillerymen only noticed this battery when 2 balls and then 4 more fell among our guns, one knocking over 2 horses and another tearing off a munition wagon driver's leg. Their spirits, once roused, were, however, not diminished, but only changed character. The horses were replaced by others from a reserve gun carriage, the wounded were carried away, and the 4 guns were turned against the 10-gun battery. Tushin's companion officer had been killed at the beginning of the engagement, and within an hour, 17 of the 40 men of the gun's crews had been disabled, but the artillerymen were still as merry and lively as ever. Twice they noticed the French appearing below them, and then they fired grape shot at them. Little Tushin, moving feebly and awkwardly, kept telling his orderly to refill my pipe for that one, and then, scattering sparks from it, ran forward, shading his eyes with his small hand to look at the French. "Smack at 'em, lads," he kept saying, seizing the guns by the wheels and working the screws himself. Amid the smoke, deafened by the incessant reports which always made him jump, Tushin, not taking his pipe from his mouth, ran from gun to gun, now aiming, now counting the charges, now giving orders about replacing dead or wounded horses and harnessing fresh ones, and shouting in his feeble voice, so high-pitched and irresolute. His face grew more and more animated. Only when a man was killed or wounded did he frown and turn away from the sight, shouting angrily at the men who, as is always the case, hesitated about lifting the injured or dead. The soldiers, for the most part handsome fellows, and, as is always the case in an artillery company, a head and shoulders taller and twice as broad as their officer, all looked at their commander like children in an embarrassing situation, and the expression on his face was invariably reflected on theirs. Owing to the terrible uproar and the necessity for concentration and activity, Tushin did not experience the slightest unpleasant sense of fear, and the thought that he might be killed or badly wounded never occurred to him. On the contrary, he became more and more elated. It seemed to him that it was a very long time ago, almost a day, since he had first seen the enemy and fired the first shot, and that the corner of the field he stood on was well-known and familiar ground. Though he thought of everything, considered everything, and did everything the best of officers could do in his position, he was in a state akin to feverish delirium or drunkenness. From the deafening sounds of his own guns around him, the whistle and thud of the enemy's cannonballs, from the flushed and perspiring faces of the crew bustling round the guns, from the sight of the blood of men and horses, from the little puffs of smoke on the enemy's side, always followed by a ball flying past and striking the earth, a man, a gun, a horse. From the sight of all these things, a fantastic world of his own had taken possession of his brain, and at that moment afforded him pleasure. The enemy's guns were in his fancy not guns, but pipes, from which occasional puffs were blown by an invisible smoker,
There. He's puffing again, muttered Tushin to himself, as a small cloud rose from the hill and was borne in a streak to the left by the wind. Now look out for the ball. We'll throw it back.
What do you want, Your Honor? Asked an artilleryman standing close by, who heard him muttering.
Nothing, only a shell, he answered. Come along, our Matveyevna, he said to himself.
Matveyevna, daughter of Matthew, was the name his fancy gave to the farthest gun of the battery, which was large and of an old pattern. The French swarming round their guns seemed to him like ants. In that world, the handsome drunkard number one of the second gun's crew was Uncle. Tushin looked at him more often than at anyone else and took delight in his every movement. The sound of musketry at the foot of the hill, now diminishing, now increasing, seemed like someone's breathing. He listened intently to the ebb and flow of these sounds.
Breathing again, breathing, he muttered to himself.
He imagined himself as an enormously tall, powerful man who was throwing cannonballs at the French with both hands.
Now then, Matveyevna, dear old lady, don't let me down, he was saying as he moved from the gun, when a strange, unfamiliar voice called above his head, Captain Tushin! Captain!
Tushin turned round in dismay. It was the staff officer who had turned him out of the booth at Grunt. He was shouting in a gasping voice,
Are you mad? You've twice been ordered to retreat, and you...
Why are they down on me? Thought Tushin, looking in alarm at his superior.
I don't... he muttered, holding up two fingers to his cap.
But the staff officer did not finish what he wanted to say. A cannonball flying close to him caused him to duck and bend over his horse. He paused, and just as he was about to say something more, another ball stopped him. He turned his horse and galloped off.
Retire! All to retire!
He shouted from a distance. The soldiers laughed. A moment later, an adjutant arrived with the same order. It was Prince Andrew. The first thing he saw on riding up to the space where Tushin's guns were stationed was an unharnessed horse with a broken leg that lay screaming piteously beside the harnessed horses. Blood was gushing from its leg as from a spring. Among the limbers lay several dead men. One ball after another passed over as he approached, and he felt a nervous shudder run down his spine. But the mere thought of being afraid roused him again. I cannot be afraid, thought he, and dismounted slowly among the guns. He delivered the order and did not leave the battery. He decided to have the guns removed from their positions and withdrawn in his presence. Together with Tushin, stepping across the bodies and under a terrible fire from the French, he attended to the removal of the guns.
A staff officer was here a minute ago but skipped off, said an artilleryman to Prince Andrew. Not like your honor.
Prince Andrew said nothing to Tushin. They were both so busy as to seem not to notice one another. When having limbered up the only two cannon that remained uninjured out of the four, they began moving down the hill. One shattered gun and one unicorn were left behind. Prince Andrew rode up to Tushin.
Well, till we meet again, he said, holding out his hand to Tushin. Goodbye, my dear fellow, said Tushin. Dear soul. Goodbye, my dear fellow.
And for some unknown reason, tears suddenly filled his eyes. Note, the unicorn referred to, like all other guns of the period, was a smoothbore muzzle loader, but was peculiar in the way it narrowed toward the muzzle. Chapter 16. Withdrawal of the Forces. Nicholas rides on a gun carriage. Tushin called to account by Bagration. Prince Andrew defends him. Nicholas's depression. The wind had fallen, and black clouds merging with the powder smoke hung low over the field of battle on the horizon. It was growing dark, and the glow of two conflagrations was the more conspicuous. The cannonade was dying down, but the rattle of musketry behind and on the right sounded oftener and nearer. As soon as Tushin, with his guns continually driving round or coming upon wounded men, was out of range of fire and had descended into the dip, he was met by some of the staff, among them the staff officer and Zherkov, who had been twice sent to Tushin's battery but had never reached it. Interrupting one another, they all gave and transmitted orders as to how to proceed, reprimanding and reproaching him. Tushin gave no orders, and silently, fearing to speak because at every word he felt ready to weep without knowing why, rode behind on his artillery nag. Though the orders were to abandon the wounded, many of them dragged themselves after the troops and begged for seats on the gun carriages. The jaunty infantry officer, who just before the battle had rushed out of Tushin's wattle shed, was laid with a bullet in his stomach on Matveyevna's carriage. At the foot of the hill, a pale hussar cadet, supporting one hand with the other, came up to Tushin and asked for a seat. "Captain, for God's sake, I've hurt my arm," he said timidly. "For God's sake, I can't walk. For God's sake." It was plain that this cadet had already repeatedly asked for a lift and been refused. He asked in a hesitating, piteous voice, "Tell them to give me a seat, for God's sake." "Give him a seat," said Tushin. "Lay a cloak for him to sit on, lad," he said, addressing his favorite soldier. "And where's the wounded officer?" "He's been set down. He died," replied someone. "Help him up. Sit down, dear fellow, sit down. Spread out the cloak, Antonov." The cadet was Rostov. With one hand he supported the other. He was pale, and his jaw trembled, shivering feverishly. He was placed on Matveyevna, the gun from which they had removed the dead officer. The cloak they spread under him was wet with blood, which stained his breeches and arm. "What, are you wounded, my lad?" said Tushin, approaching the gun on which Rostov sat. "No, it's a sprain." "What is this blood on the gun carriage?" inquired Tushin.
"It was the officer, Your Honor, stained it," answered the artilleryman, wiping away the blood with his coat sleeve, as if apologizing for the state of his gun. It was all that they could do to get the guns up the rise, aided by the infantry, and having reached the village of Gruntersdorf, they halted. It had grown so dark that one could not distinguish the uniforms 10 paces off, and the firing had begun to subside.